So, the topic of today is the last two factors, the last of the five hindrances, and the last of the five faculties. For the hindrances, the last in English is usually translated as doubt, and for the last of the faculties, the English usual translation is wisdom. And these are often paired, that wisdom is the antidote for doubt. And it might seem like doubt is a big, sophisticated topic, but maybe not. I'm fond of the Aesop fable about the tortoise and the hare. And I identify or appreciate most the tortoise. And my image of this tortoise in the race is the tortoise is slow but persistent. And the task for the tortoise is to put one foot in front of the other, which is pretty simple. Just keep doing it. Keep doing it steadily. And as most of us know, the tortoise won the race, partly because the tortoise wasn't distracted by things. It just kept just this going and going. And what we're talking about here, you know, these five faculties and five hindrances, the central reference point for it is the practice. They apply to all kinds of things in daily life as well. But then it often gets a little more complicated to exactly understand the correlation. But in the practice, doing this practice, maybe it's as simple. Maybe we're all asked to be the tortoise. I have a friend who has a tattoo on her ankle that is of a tortoise. And I never asked her about it, but my assumption or my fantasy is that it's there because when she sits cross-legged to meditate, it looked down, it's always there. Maybe if she looks down because, oh no, it's so hard. And then, just one breath after the next breath, then next breath, next step. And it's just there, the persistence, just this. And, you know, I think probably to limit the practice only to the breath and only to the next step is too limited. But often that's what it's about. But to make it more sophisticated, for a sophisticated audience, it's the slow and steady practice, step after step, breath after breath, moment after moment, is the practice to show up. Just show up. Show up for this life. Show up for the present moment. Show up. And if you wanted to have it a little more complicated, show up with all of yourself. Don't leave any of yourself behind. Some of you know that one of the reasons I like the Pali literal meaning of Buddham Saranam Gacchami, Dhammam Saranam Gacchami, Sangham Saranam Gacchami, is that the middle word Gacchami can also mean to walk. And when you walk, you know, if you go someplace in the car, well, you bring all of yourself, kind of. But you could be taking a nap in the back seat, and the car takes you there. But when you walk, you bring all of yourself including your, you know, giving yourself over to the task, your whole body goes along. So we show up with all of who we are. And maybe that's one of the great tasks, is to realize that that's not so easy, but to find out how to do that, to discover what we're leaving behind, what we're leaving out. And the reason not to leave anything out, one reason is that because you're important. You and your life is valuable. There's nothing in the Buddha Dharma, in the teachings of the Buddha, that gives any idea that you're anything less than valuable or important. Each person is someone we can respect, revere, honor, see as important. Each of us, including ourselves. So to leave some of ourselves behind is to shortchange ourselves. So to show up fully here, and there's this English expression, you know, warts and all, or the good, the bad, and the ugly. But this showing up for it doesn't mean we act it out. This is not act everything. Just show up for everything. Show up for who we are, honestly, fully. This is who I am. A good number of years ago now, I went to a meeting of some of the most senior Zen teachers in the United States. And they were going to have a kind of personal time together, semi-personal. It was still kind of formal, sitting in a circle and having a conversation. But so at some point the conversation went to, what are you practicing with these days? After 40, 50 years of practice, what are you practicing with these days? And what was remarkable, as people went around the circle, to me, I was deeply touched by it, was that I don't think any of them presented themselves as perfect or complete or finished in their practice. I think it was no one said, like, well, I had this little issue about pride around how perfect I am. But, you know, some of them talk about their fear. And the struggles with after all these years, they still had fear, or still had this and that. So it's quite something to hear that after years and years of practice, that this can still be a part of their practice. But what touched me the most was how relaxed they were about it. Almost like they didn't take it personally, the most personal thing they were saying. Like, well, this is what's going on, and there was no shame and no embarrassment and no idea that they were bad or this was a mistake. Here or there, they had this, you know, they were senior teachers. They should be over all these things. They should be presenting this perfect impression, like, I'm a good practitioner. I have no problems. What problems? What problems? No self, no problem. But that wasn't how they present themselves, among themselves. You know, so I was quite touched by that. Was the openness, the kind of freedom they had to just say they were not free completely. So this show up with everything you have, and how to do it in an honest and full way. Of course, you can't always have that full honesty to everyone you meet. But at least to yourself, at least to the Dharma, when you show up, that's what the Dharma is waiting for us, to show up with all of who we are And one of the reasons the Dharma is waiting for us, there is one way that the Buddha says that the Dharma is you. You're not different from the Dharma. And so to show up fully as you are, then you meet the Dharma. When the Dharma is the Dharma, you are you, fully. So to show up, and a lot of it has to do with them really kind of being present for what's happening, attentive, giving our attention, giving our presence, giving our embodied engagement with what's happening. This is important. I think there's some koan or question that says, what's the most important thing? Whatever's in front of me right now is the answer. So the persistence is simple showing up moment after moment. But it's not easy, because it's hard to have that confidence, trust in the value of this simple, ongoing, just show up, show up. The mind thinks it has to have answers, it has to have planned ahead and solved things, and we have to make so many decisions, and they're complicated, our life, and all this stuff. And all those things are true. You can't deny that we live complicated lives. But the Dharma doesn't necessarily solve all our problems. Maybe you have to do that, hopefully. But the Dharma has to do about how you show up for life's problems. And maybe if you show up fully, maybe the problems are not as much problems. Maybe they become something else. I don't know what the word problems means for you, but when any time there's a problem that has some kind of feeling of a personal problem, it feels like heavy on my shoulders. Like, oh, this is a burden. This is like, now we're talking about serious. But when you show up fully for these things that have to be figured out and things that have to be understood and whatever, maybe they're not problems like that. Maybe they're puzzles. Maybe they're reflections, considerations. Maybe they're decisions that have to be made. And so there's a different feeling for it. And so what is it that presents us to show up that way? One of the things that presents us from showing up this way is the strong identification with self. Strong ideas we have that we have to be a certain way, or show ourselves a certain way, or hide ourselves in a certain way, or be a certain kind of spiritual person, or be this or that, or... And then we're not showing up as ourselves, but we're showing up with a kind of baggage, like I talked about the other day. All this heavy things, the things that kind of heavy, you know, cause that weight on the shoulders. So this beautiful thing about just showing up fully, it's both you who shows up and not you. Who else would show up but you, all of you? But maybe it doesn't have to be with a definition of who you are. Maybe it doesn't have to be with an idea you have to prove who you are. Maybe it doesn't have to be with the idea that you have to defend or hide who you are. Just show up. Like those Zen teachers who just showed up and said, this is how I am. I have all this fear, and I have to give these Dharma talks, and I'm really afraid still. Or at least giving Dharma talk for 40 years, I'm still nervous beforehand. And I'm still practicing with that. Just show up without needing to be the weight of it. And so the simplicity of the tortoise practice of just showing up over and over again, what we will begin to discover, and this is a necessary discovery, I think, we discover all the many ways we don't show up fully. And rather than seeing that as a mistake, it's what we have to see and learn so we can show up. So the Dharma reaction, the Dharma response to showing, to noticing that I'm not fully myself here, I'm not really showing up fully, I'm holding back and I'm not going to open up here, or I'm going to not really share something because I really want to get the cookie. But if I hold back and not get in the way, maybe no one will notice that I'm walking over to the cookie. You know, if they don't notice me, then I can get the cookie. Or something. It's seeing, oh, this is how I operate. And so rather than seeing, saying, oh, shoot, boy, am I a lousy person. I must be the lousiest person on the retreat. Because I'm trying to get to the front of the line early enough, get down there without anybody noticing that I'm hurrying. Because you can't show if you're greedy. So I'm going to get down there, but no one's going to know. I'm going to go really slow. But I figured out the route, and I figured out the gate. And, you know, how long I should sit in my seat before popping up. But I don't want to get up too soon because then people see I'm not so mindful. But if I, you know, just calculate. It's a lot of math to do so that I can be early enough to be close enough to the front of the line so I can get one of the cookies. And you finally manage. But that day there's no cookies. So what I'm trying to say here is discovering how we don't show up fully without saying I'm lousy or bad, but saying, wow, my good fortune. I just saw how I don't show up fully. I just saw how I'm attached or I'm afraid, or I got to see that. Wow. I can't wait to tell someone. Not everyone and anyone right away, but, you know, when you get to go to those meetings, sit around the circle, and what are you practicing with? You? Oh, I can't believe my good luck. I saw how much I hold myself back from being honest or something. I don't want to be vulnerable. Isn't that something? Isn't that great that I saw that? So this part of becoming wise in this tradition, a really important part of becoming wise, the last of the faculty, is to see how we're attached, how we get caught, how we don't show up. And this idea that the practice is the Dharma, just to show up moment by moment, is a nice reference point, because then you can ask yourself, did I not show up? How did I not show up so fully? How was I something other way? But don't use that as a way to prove yourself, you know, a bad person. But if you see how you don't show up, say, oh, great. I guess this is where I'm going to practice. So what the doubt, the fifth hindrance, has the meaning of certainly doubt, but also vacillation, uncertainty, hesitation. So in relationship to showing up, taking the next step in practice, it's unsure about taking that next step. It's being uncertain, is this the right step? Should I just stepped with my left foot. Now, is it really the right to do? Should I appropriately do the right foot now? Or should I take a little bit longer step with the left foot? And which foot should I go next? Or should I do a somersault? what should I do? And then we don't go to do it all, right? So the idea is, what should I do here? And I'm not sure what to do. And am I the right person to step? I don't know if I know how to step properly. And maybe stepping should be different. The way I was trained was to step. Actually, I never went to stepping school. So maybe my steps are not really kosher or up to snuff or something, and especially for a Buddhist retreat center where they do all this walking meditation. I'm sure there's a right way to walk. And so we're all this uncertainty, all this doubt, all this hesitation and uncertainty. And so there's a whole world that kind of holds us back, keeps us from showing up, going to the next thing, being there, fully there. It has a lot to do with hesitation and uncertainty and not knowing what it, not only being uncertain, but having, I think of doubt as being more powerful than uncertainty. It's having serious questions whether something is worth doing or appropriate to do. And so that can be debilitating as a practitioner when we have doubt about ourselves. I don't know if I'm really up to this. I don't know if I can do it. Or about the practice. I don't know about this practice. This practice, doesn't seem to be very, promising. It seems like I should, I don't know about this showing up thing. I've heard about jhanas and deep concentration states and bliss and great states of emptiness, and I don't know about this. Just show up for the next moment. Give me a break. I want the big bang spirituality. So I not knowing, not having doubt about the showing up, not knowing that it's the full showing up that leads to the maturity in this practice. The saying that I'm quite fond of, I say it a lot, is the Dharma is to go someplace. There is a place to get to in this practice, in a sense. But in the Dharma, the fastest way to go from A to B is to be fully at A. Show up fully for this, whatever it is, just show up for it. And then things begin to, the Dharma begins to flow, emerge, happen. Maybe not automatically or, quickly, but to be racing to be, then you become the hare that was racing against the tortoise. So this vacillation, hesitation, doubt, it's sometimes said that the fifth hindrance is the most debilitating, the most dangerous, because it's the one that can get people to stop practicing. And I have a friend who was at a three-month retreat at IMS back in Massachusetts. And in the middle of the retreat, something happened. She got this strong message from inside herself, like she had to go back home. And she told people she had to leave the retreat, and she got a plane ticket, and she was flying across the country, and in the middle of the flight she said, "Oh, wait a minute, what just happened?" And she said, "I just had a multiple hindrance attack." And doubt was the most strongest one. And only when she was in the plane did she realize what it was. And then she kind of regretted leaving the retreat. The alternative is to show up for the doubt, show up for the hindrances. And after a while, to get a feeling for what it's like to show up, what it's like to have some kind of clear recognition, oh, this is what's happening. And even if you don't know what's happening, a clear recognition, something is happening here. I don't know what it is. Something, but the clarity showing up, oh, this, something is here. After a while, we get a feel for that clarity, a feel for the embodied sense of being present. We get a feel for the honesty of the mind that knows, oh, this is difficult. I'm vacillating, I'm hesitating, I'm pulling back. I'm questioning, I'm doubting. And what does it mean to show up for this fully? And if after a while, if you have a feeling for what it's like to show up fully or see clearly or recognize fully, not that you recognize the thing that's being recognized, but you get a sense for what's the act of recognition, the act of seeing, of knowing. You get a sense of how there's freedom in that, how there's some kind of, you know, life in that. And that becomes, then you know when you're not doing that. And when you're not doing that, be careful. Be careful with the decisions you make. Be careful with the interpretations you make of the situation. So doubt. One of my favorite practices with doubt is to doubt doubt. So, why not? Sometimes, and the why not is sometimes doubt comes with authority, with a strength, with a kind of like a. And it's fascinating to feel the sense of authority, the sense of insistence that, oh, you know, I can't do this. And this is probably the wrong time. And after a while, it doesn't become doubt anymore. It becomes, I don't think I should be doing this practice or doing this retreat or doing this or whatever. And then it becomes, I'm certain I should leave. I should switch over and do some other practice. And it's fascinating to watch that, how uncertainty can go to certainty, and how that kind of certainty is built on something which maybe is not very stable or is not really well informed, or that it is more our reaction to being uncomfortable with doubt or hesitation, uncertainty. So to show up. And I get a sense of what it's like not to show up. So you're not so easily fooled. You're not so easily pulled into the authority that comes along with the doubt. Doubt the doubt. If doubt is a lawyer, don't just, you know, trust the lawyers who are arguing a case. Bring your lawyer. Wait a minute, you know? How do you know? How are you so sure that there's reason to doubt here? I doubt the doubt. It's hard to do this because doubt is so convincing. But what I'm trying to also suggest here is to kind of begin to feel and sense the conviction in it, the insistence, the authority, the power of these things. And then if you get a sense of that, then you know, so that conviction is often invisible. It's just kind of like we think that it's true, so we have to kind of follow along with it. But it's really helpful to see the energy behind all these hindrances, conviction or the confidence of the energy behind desire and aversion, even sloth and torpor, restlessness, regrets, and doubt. And you get a feel for that push or that power or that conviction that gives them their power over us. So to show up and show up. And show up step after step, breath after breath, moment after moment. I'd like to, like I said at the beginning, I'd like to emphasize that as something very simple. The tortoise wins the race. Just show up and be present this honestly here for this right here. In terms of wisdom, one of my favorite quotes in the suttas these days is the Buddha's definition of a wise person. A wise person is concerned for the welfare of themselves, the welfare of others, the welfare of self and others, and the welfare of the whole world. I love this idea. That's what a wise person is. It would have been nice if I had read that quote before I went to get a PhD in Buddhist studies. And it also seems so simple. And a wise person is not someone who has a PhD in Buddhist studies or has, you know, amassed a tremendous amount of knowledge and knows the ins and outs of Buddhist psychology and metaphysics and all that. But this very human, simple human capacity to care for others and for oneself. A wise person cares for people. The list, self, other, self and other, and the world, begins with oneself. And some people find that hard because they think it's selfish. But we have so much more care to give to others when we've cared for ourselves properly. And actually, if we haven't cared for ourselves enough in a wise way, then our attempts to care for others sometimes is misplaced. So then, if you go to other teachings of the Buddha, when he has his teachings on the five faculties, and when he gets to the wisdom faculty, he defines here wisdom as a kind of insight. So I kind of sometimes think this word panya, translated as wisdom, prajna, should be, sometimes it has a more like closer to the English idea of insight. Because wisdom maybe has this connotation sometimes of knowledge that you've learned, maybe, you know, some wisdom that you've acquired, and you carry it with you in your backpack and pull it out when's needed. But insight means that you're discovering the wisdom, the understanding in the moment, because you're seeing it. And this is how the definition is, that as a faculty, the wisdom faculty, is to see the changing nature of our lives, to see things appear and disappear, come and go, arise and pass. And things arise and pass, come and go, all the time. But to appreciate this wisdom, this insight into how things are changing and moving, I think there's a fascinating way of appreciating this. First, I'll say that in preparation for explaining it, that we're often preoccupied with things, and we often want to reify things, we often are focusing on objects. Like if I'm really concerned about seeing something, searching for something with my eyes, you know, I'm looking, my eyes are looking for the object. I'm out there and interested out there. And if it's really important, I'm not paying attention to myself doing the looking, because I need to find my keys so I can go to meditate. Go to the meditation center and... you know, I better get there. I have to get there so I can relax. and so I'm looking for those keys and not noticing that I'm tensing up. So when we say seeing the changing nature of everything, some people then get into the equivalent of looking for that out there. And it can be seen out there, and I'll talk about that. But one of the ways is that our perception of things, the way that we take in phenomena, experience, is constantly shifting. Naturally so. So if you're walking in a nice park, your favorite park maybe, if you have one, with a nice friend, and you're just walking along and you're having a nice conversation, you're mostly involved in the conversation, just your eyes, just choose one sense organ. Your eyes are not thinking, you know, you're thinking and involved in the conversation. But your eyes notice that there's a turn in the path. And you can take the turn, you don't walk off the path. It notices some gravel you have to be careful with. It notices there's a bird flying by or some tortoise and hares that are trying to go up someplace. Yeah, but your conversation is so interesting, that you don't really think about it, but you see leaves falling from the trees, you see leaves rustling. And in fact, what's happening is as you walk, the perspective of, there's a tree up ahead, and as you walk, the perspective and all the things you see in the tree are rapidly changing as you walk because of the perspective. So what's happening as you're seeing is constantly shifting and changing in very small, quick ways. And so the perceptions have a coming and going to them. You could say, well, the tree's not coming and going. It's appearing and it's appearing and it's there. But our perception of a tree in a certain way is that a perception is shifting and changing from leaves to the trunk to the roots and to all kinds of things, shifting and changing. And in fact, if you don't let your eyesight kind of roam and take in all this, the eyes actually will get strained. I mean, if you fixate, so you might want to try this. Maybe some of you have done this before, but find a spot in front of you to stare at, like a little dot, and then just really kind of hold your attention, your eyes fixed in. Don't waver. Just like really look at that, and don't let your eyes kind of like zero in, like laser, like you're gonna really zap it. Like you burn a hole in the floor by staring at it long enough. And chances are, unless you think this is too funny, what I'm saying is that you'll feel in your body tense, something locks up, something is, has to work. But now, if you look at the same object, even if it's small, but let your attention roam around it, like the bottom, the top, the sides, kind of trace the perimeter of it if there's one, or just let your eyes kind of roam. Chances are something relaxes compared to how you were before. The eyes are kind of designed to constantly shift and move and roam around. Maybe you've seen studies where they've tracked the pupils as eyes are looking at art. And what they can see, all this, the pathway they're looking, and what. So our perception of things is constantly shifting and changing. So it gets fascinating if you get to do this with pain. And if I think of pain as something horrific and terrible and frightening, and we make our future predictions and the ideas of it, the ideas lend themselves to a kind of permanence, a kind of constancy. But if we're able to do the same thing with the pain as you did with the spot on the floor, maybe, and just kind of let your attention roam, the contours of the pain, the center of it, and just kind of roam around, really go into it, then something inside of us doesn't get locked up and tight, hopefully. As if it did, if we kind of resisted it, then get caught up in the, this is too hard, I can't do this, all the reactions we have. And pain becomes something different, a different thing. Our relationship to it, what goes on, a little bit different at times if we allow this soft roaming around. Same way with the breathing. Some people try so hard to stay focused on the breath. They have this idea they're supposed to be a laser focused and just like not waver, and they're never supposed to lose a breath and just right there. And they make themselves tense. But is there an equivalent of kind of letting your attention kind of be bounded by breathing, like, but then kind of let it gently roam and stay with it? The two factors of concentration that sometimes talked about are the application of mind to the object of attention and the sustained attention on the object. The metaphor, ancient metaphor for that is that the initial one is taking a piece of cloth and placing it on a brass bowl. And the sustained attention is not just like holding it there. It's actually taking that with a cloth and polishing the bowl. Going around like this, polishing it, roaming. Like it's not fixed, not held. So as we to see the arising and passing of things, there's two areas we see that. We see it in the nature of our perception, things come and go and shift all the time. And then as we do that, some things will arise and pass. Dogs barking. It's there for a moment, then it's not there. You know, if I look at the ceiling, it's not going. It's there. What do you mean these Buddhists say things are rising and passing all the time? The ceiling is there. The perception, all the little sense data, the bits of information coming in from which we then reconstruct the ceiling, and that's shifting and changing all the time. And we're drawn to certain things and we go around and watch. And like I keep being drawn to one of the squares up there because it doesn't seem to be quite right from this angle. So I watch my mind getting a little fixated. But, you know, if I don't pay attention to that one that's wrong, it just, you know, it's something is constantly shifting and changing. Why is this important? Why is this a form of wisdom or insight? Because the mind that's able to see the shifting, changing, coming and going, appearing, disappearing, perceiving and not perceiving, the shift, the roaming, the shifting and changing, is a mind that's not fixated. A mind that hasn't latched on and gotten tight. It's not clinging to anything. And so the wisdom, the simple wisdom of insight meditation, is to begin appreciating in some relaxed way. Don't search for this, then you're probably fixating. But to kind of begin trusting the natural, easy way in which attention, all forms of our attentional capacity, sensing and feeling and knowing and recognizing cognitively, and there's a constant shifting and moving and coming and going. If I have the thought, wow, I'm a lousy meditator. Well, there was wow. It came and went. There was lousy, came and went. Even more detailed, there was the L of lousy, and then there was a C of lousy. It came and it went, and then there was, I came and went. Look at that. Where did I came and went? Did I, you know, then you can get it philosophically involved. Well, did I come and go? Did I only exist when the I is there? When I say it, who am I? Well, the who arose and then disappeared. The M arose, it disappeared. The I arose and disappeared. The who am I arose and it passed away. Unless you get fixated on it, like, oh, this is an important word. This is like the important sentence. No doubt. Like, this is the key sentence. I am a lousy meditator. This, like, the world has never had a more important sentence that's ever been said. This is like the most, the moment, like, this is it. But if instead you had that thought, of course you might have something equivalent, each of us. But if you have this kind of simple showing up with a simple, relaxed attention, so you're fully there for it and you see that the parts of that sentence are just coming and going. And it's almost like you see the contours of it. You see the appearing and disappearing. It's just things, ideas and words coming and going. Then you might also notice that you're adding something to it. You're adding a fixation to it, a preoccupation with it, an intense interest in those words. And then if you look at that, the interest, the preoccupation we have with it, guess what? If you look at that in the same relaxed way, that's also coming and going, or being perceived and not perceived, and this strong kind of like a really intentness about like something is wrong here and I have to look and figure out what it is. And then the dog barks. But then it's really important. I'd be right back. And so it seems like you're always doing it. You're always having this thing, intent, this is important and this is like this most, you know, something inside of you. And then someone in the hall rustles. You're equanimous about it. You're okay, you hardly notice, but you took it in, and then you're back to the important thing. And then your knee hurts, and you're back to the important thing. And then you're hungry, and I wonder what they're having for lunch, and then you're back to the important thing. And so you don't notice, your inner sense, without thinking about it, is it's the only thing happening. The whole meditation is this intensity around this problem you have. But in fact, it's constantly shifting, coming in and out. You happen to come back to that all the time. So it lends itself to permanence. But what if you just kind of relax and begin appreciating, wow, there's something here that's coming and going, appearing and disappearing, shifting and changing, and not only in what we see or hear or feel, but also in the act of perception itself, in the act of knowing, and the cognitive act of recognition. So all these shifts and going on. And that's where some freedom can come. That's where there's an invitation. Awakening beckons us, invites us, welcomes us within everything. Because if it's true that everything is arising and passing, coming, going in this kind of way, in perception, then the holding on, the clinging to it, is a little extra. Maybe it's not needed. And in fact, maybe it doesn't work. One of the really fascinating discoveries, humbling, infuriating discoveries. It turns out that all we ever cling to, unless you're on the edge of a cliff holding onto the railing, the only thing we really are really clinging to is ideas. Ideas of the people we are important for us, ideas of the things. It's always ideas. And the ideas, because we cling to them, they lend themselves to this kind of illusion that they're kind of permanent, they're kind of fixed. This is how they are. I've held on to resentment to a certain person for a long time, for years, kind of. Just not too seriously, in the background, you know, it's there, floating in and out, maybe. And then after some years, I saw the person, and I realized this person's gotten older, changed, put on weight, all kinds of things. And I realized, Gil, you had frozen the person in time. Your idea was that person who said something 10 years ago. But that's not longer who the person is. So we cling to ideas. And we start breaking up the hegemony of this kind of clinging to ideas when we start kind of trusting and relaxing and noticing how there's constantly that things are coming in and out of perception, in and out of being known. And there's constantly shifting in what's known in the moment. And so the ideas we hold on to, we're not actually that good at holding on to them, because the dog barks and we're concerned about that. And then we smell the cookies. And then we wonder about the cookies. And then you remember, I'm supposed to be thinking about my person I'm resentful for. And so you come back to business. And then, you know, this happens and that happens. But if we start kind of settling back, showing up, but also settling back to really be present and seeing, letting all the things kind of just come into this relaxed attention that kind of allows itself to roam. Not floating away roaming, but kind of just present for the, you know, the bell and polishing it, present for the breathing. In a sense, kind of polishing the breathing with attention, just letting it roam and move around and feeling the in-breath and out-breath. Hearing a sound and let the vibrations, the coming and going, come into your ear. And the sensations of your body, the thoughts that come and go. It's fascinating to break down. If you think in words, it's fascinating to break it down into, away from the whole idea of the whole sentence you say, to the individual words. Who am I? Who? That's fascinating. It just came and went. Who? M. Oh. I. What if I drop the I? What if I just say who? M. What if I just say who? What then? So anyway, we can start playing and kind of being relaxed and seeing, you know, rather than getting stuck on the full meaning of the word. Not that the question isn't good, and not that the ideas don't have an important part of our life, but when we're meditating and practicing, as the faculty of wisdom that really develops, it really becomes a strength. That's why it's particularly in meditation, or that this has a chance to kind of make an impression on us, is to start taking in, noticing, seeing, in the present moment, in the moment as things unfold, as the present moment is flowing by, in that present moment, what attention is doing is constantly taking in new things, and things come into awareness and leave awareness, come into awareness, leave awareness. And sometimes it's good to have the breathing as a default so that you don't, you know, a little anchor, they call it, so you don't actually float away with your roaming attention, but just the coming and going of the breath. And then it loosens up, it helps loosen up the fixations, the holding on, the attachments that try to hold things as being hold on to things or fixate on things. And one of the things that we fixate on is doubt, uncertainty, hesitation, vacillation. But what if that's also just one more thing in the field of things coming and going that we're aware of and not aware of? And if we can see it that way, just one more thing that comes and goes, there's a turning point in practice, but that when we have more confidence in being present for the inconstant changing nature of phenomena than we have in doubt. The ideas of doubt, the questions of doubt, the uncertainty of doubt. Some doubts are appropriate to have. So some wisdom is needed for knowing, you know, but still, when we're practicing, the confidence goes to the practice, showing up and being present and seeing the unfolding of things more than being fixated on the ideas, which is what happens when we're doubting. So, you might consider, as you continue the practice on this retreat, think of yourself more as a hare than more as a tortoise than a hare. More as a tortoise than a hare. And just kind of be content to keep showing up step after step, moment after moment, but maybe with a relaxed attention that can just kind of flow and roam and be present for things, but not fixate on anything, but there's a softness and a roaming and presence. May you practice at the speed that allows your attention to really see how things are constantly shifting and moving and coming and going in your field of perception. So, thank you all.